from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Pope Francis is about to embark on his 45th trip. This time he heads back to Asia and Oceania, visiting four countries in 11 days. Frank Rocha, EWTN News Vatican analyst, joins us with his take on the significance of this trip. Then, returning to the 2024 U.S. election, a decision on abortion will be before many voters, November 5th. Which states are facing abortion-related ballot measures? That's what we talk about with Register's staff writer, Peter Laughlin. And finally, we'll get a preview of the Paralympics taking place in Paris with Register Europe correspondent Solène Tadier. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Executive Director of the National Catholic Register and Catholic News Agency, your host here on Register Radio, joined by my co-host Matthew Bunsen, who is the Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News. So we are delighted to have two colleagues, Courtney Mares and Danielle Ibanez, traveling on the papal train for this epic trip to Asia and Oceania. That trip begins September 2nd, so we're talking before they're probably packing their bags, but they're not on this trip yet. It concludes September 13th. Colm Flynn, another colleague for EWTN News, went to these countries ahead of the Pope and brought us news of what's happening in those countries and the Catholic communities there via EWTN, and that will be on EWTN News in depth. So we're delighted now to have Frank Rocha, Vatican analyst, joining us. He worked for a long time for the Wall Street Journal, and now he's with EWTN News. Frank, it's so good to have you.
Great to be here, Jeanette and Matthew.
So we're looking at an 87-year-old Pope. That's how old Pope Francis is, who's taking his longest trip. And some call this his most ambitious trip. He's going to Indonesia, Papua New Guinea, East Timor, and Singapore. Packed schedule. But let's get an overview, Frank. What do we expect to be the major highlights?
Well, yeah, as you say, it's remarkable. It's a very long trip. He's 87. Uses a wheelchair. He's had respiratory problems. It recalls the epic trips that John Paul took back in the day. So the schedule, it's not quite as packed as the schedule in his very early days of Pope Francis' trips in the first years. But it's not a super light schedule either. He's got mm-hmm. several events on those days. Indonesia is a country with the largest Muslim population in the world, and as we know, Pope Francis has put a priority on dialogue with the Muslim world. So that's an obvious theme there. Interreligious dialogue will be certainly something he'll be talking about there and promoting. Indonesia is also known for a kind of moderate form of Islam, and there are many people there, leaders who are interested in peaceful coexistence and developing that idea that the Pope has promoted with his human fraternity initiative. And in Papua New Guinea, a natural topic is going to be another major theme of this pontificate, which is care for creation, the environment. Papua New Guinea is a country where it's really felt the effects of climate change, and there's concern about rising sea levels and landslides and that sort of thing. So we wouldn't be surprised if he's going to talk about the environment there. Mm-hmm. Poverty and inequality will also probably come up in these trips when he goes to Papua New Guinea. Is certainly a country. All of these countries have high degrees of inequality. Singapore is notable for being a very wealthy country and one of the Asian tiger economies. So perhaps he'll address inequalities between rich and poor when he's there. And then the penultimate stop right before Singapore is Timor-Leste, East Timor, which is an almost entirely Catholic country. It's, in fact, maybe the most Catholic country in the world, if you don't count Vatican City. There is a sex abuse issue. Bishop Carlos Jimenez Bello, who was a Nobel Prize winner for his work in the peaceful, nonviolent movement to achieve independence from Indonesia. He a couple of years ago, the Vatican revealed that he'd been disciplined after accusations of sex abuse. So that's kind of a shadow that might or might not come up in directly or indirectly in the Pope's remarks.
Yeah, Frank, Pope Francis has visited Asia, especially East Asia, Far East Asia, and now Southeast Asia on a number of occasions. We've had trips to Myanmar, to South Korea, to Japan. Why is Asia so important to him, and how does this reflect his broader vision in terms of the pontificate?
Yeah, I think there are a number of issues. I mean, one is, you know, he's really made put a priority on reaching out beyond the Catholic world. And so, in obviously, the Philippines is a Catholic country, and so is East Timor. But in general, when going to that region, he's dealing with Muslims, Buddhists. He's dealing with people who are not Catholics. And that's really been a priority for him. By contrast, as we know, he hasn't gone at all in his pontificate to Spain, which is where his Jesuit order was founded. He hasn't gone to Germany, so he's kind of not put a priority on the wealthy countries in the Catholic Christian heartland. Of course, you know, he is a Jesuit, and they have a tradition from the 16th century of outreach to Asia, missionary work in Asia, so he's following in that tradition as well.
I love to think about the fact, too, that, you know, it's really the statistically probably the future of the world, right? I mean, I think I read 1 in 9 Catholics worldwide is there in Asia. So it seems that we're thinking about the future. And Frank, I was imagining, what if there was an appearance like Our Lady of Guadalupe, right, in the Asia, just how many conversions there might be. Like, it's something to pray for. In this moment where people leave the church and become nuns to actually have some kind of dramatic conversion in Asia. So certainly something to pray for. What might we look for in this trip if we're kind of watching and seeing? What kind of messages are we likely to hear?
Well, again, I think there will be he will be talking, I should expect, about peaceful coexistence with non-Christians. And again, in Indonesia, there's been a high amount of cooperation. The Catholic minority is small; it's about 3%. But you know, the Muslim leaders have been very friendly in many cases to Catholics and Christians, and so I think he'll celebrate that and emphasize that. We can expect that. And again, I think he will be probably talking about protecting creation. He's going to be a lot of these places. He'll be doing the usual things. He'll be meeting with the bishops. He'll be meeting with the civil authorities and the leaders. He'll be meeting with the religious orders. And he'll be meeting with Jesuits. That's another thing. Whenever he meets... Oh, sorry.
The Jesuits.
Right. When he meets with the Jesuits, he gives these talks, which are then transcribed and released later, and they often have some very provocative and interesting statements in them. And then, of course, let's remember that he'll give at least one press conference during this trip. It's been a year since he's done that. And so it's quite possible he'll say something newsworthy, and that will come out during the trip or right afterwards. Certainly, some reporters will probably try to get him to say something about the U.S. elections, there are other issues that have been hanging around for a long time since he hasn't given a press conference in a year.
Absolutely. So for our listeners' sake, you can turn to the EWTN News app and find EWTN News In-Depth that aired August 30th. That's a preview of the papal trip from some of that footage and interviews shot by Colm Flynn. And, of course, you can follow those colleagues of ours on the ground this week at Catholic News Agency and EWTN News Nightly and also at the Register. Frank, thank you for joining us. Everybody, you've been listening to Register Radio on EWTN News, and we'll be taking a short break and then coming back with Peter Laufen to talk about the latest news on abortion-related proposals that you may see on your state ballot this November. Stay tuned for more.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Executive Director of the National Catholic Register and Catholic News Agency, your host here on Register Radio, with my co-host Matthew Bunsen, who's Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News. Our Register staff writer Peter Laufen joins us today as well to talk about abortion on the ballot. So Pro-abortion measures are now on ballots in 10 states, including Montana, Nevada, Colorado, Arizona, South Dakota, Missouri, New York, Maryland, Florida, and Nebraska. And in some of these states, if these amendments pass, it would enshrine existing state laws into the constitutions in those states. Then it would make basically a quote-unquote constitutional right to abortion in those states. But other measures are a bit more substantial in the sense that the states, that these amendments would change the law in that state. It would actually change the status of abortion in that state right now. So it's very complex, and Peter's here to help us try to boil this down. So Peter, I'm grateful for your time in taking a rather complex 10 amendments and trying to boil it down. So let's start with, where are the places that are really making the biggest change with these ballot initiatives?
Well, thanks so much for having me, Jeanette. Yeah, like you say, some of these states are just cementing what is already there should these pro-abortion amendments pass. But there are other states where there would be real changes in people's practical lives in relation to abortion in these states, and that occurs mostly in the red states. For instance, in the state of Missouri, where Amendment 3 is up for the vote in November, the current existing law in Missouri protects unborn babies throughout the entire pregnancy, and the only exceptions being the case for a medical emergency, the life of the mother. But Amendment 3, if it passed, would do away with that. It would quote unquote prohibit any regulation of abortion, including regulations designed to protect women undergoing abortions. So, that's a massive change. It's the difference between protecting the unborn throughout pregnancy and not. In other states, such as Montana, the issue seems to be fetal viability and questions around that. Right now, it is legal to have an abortion up until about 24 weeks, which is usually when viability is decided on. And now, should their abortion amendment pass, you're going to see a change to whenever the doctor deems it necessary to mm-hmm. protect the life of the woman, which is an entirely different question. And both of those definitions are a little ambiguous. And so it's going to be difficult to see even, what happens at that point. But still, that would be a major practical change. Another state, Nebraska, there's currently a law where protect the unborn, and now we're seeing dueling ballot measures where you have one that is a pro-abortion and one that is an anti-abortion ballot amendment, and whichever one passes with the most votes is going to be the law of the land. So again, that's hugely consequential, and so these big changes are mostly taking places in red states where there are laws on the book to protect the unborn.
And of course, you have a couple other states too where this is really a battleground. I'm thinking of Arizona and Florida, which those are two important states in almost any election, right? So mm-hmm. yeah. Both of those states have real changes here that could be done by this this ballot. I'll talk about Arizona. I know you've been talking to people in Florida, but in Arizona, abortion is illegal before 15 weeks of pregnancy. And this, if the ballot measure passes, it would be legal up to 24 weeks. But what about Florida? You've been talking to people there. You've been covering the state of Florida. It's abortion's illegal after 6 weeks. What are we looking at?
So I have very good sources in Florida. People are really plugged into the legalities of this, into the specific language of these bills, and also people who are very in tune to what's happening on the ground with voters. And there's a news organization that just did they ran the numbers for voter registrations before and after Joe Biden withdrew from the race. And what they found is, after Biden withdrew from the race, there was a huge spike in voter registration among young women, Gen Z women. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This also corresponds with other news that we're getting out of Florida, that the pro-life movement is being outspent by tens of millions of dollars. Florida, the pro-abortion movement raised was able to garner well over a million signatures, which is far more than they needed to pass this measure. Now, Florida is a little different than these other states because it takes 60% of the vote for this amendment to pass. In the other states, it's just a 50% threshold, but in Florida, it's 60%. However, polls have right now that number being right around that 60% marker in favor of passing this amendment. And if the other markers that we're seeing in terms of voter registration and just general campaign momentum turn out to be true, it looks like the Amendment 3 in Florida has a very good chance of passing.
Yeah, Peter, there has been much discussion about the response of the Republicans, in particular the national ticket, Trump Vance. The Democrats obviously seem to consider abortion, as you've just noted, to be a potential winner for them in galvanizing the vote. But the Republicans at the same time seem to be steering away from abortion. First, how have they done that? And second, how likely is this now to play out in the state level, and in what way?
So first, about the Republicans and the National Republican Party and their response to the issue of abortion for the upcoming election. We had a couple of troubling things happen in the past week in the Trump-Vance ticket. J.D. Vance came out and said that Donald Trump will veto any national pro-life law that hit his desk. And again, like that's a pretty incredible development that I think the pro-life movement is still sort of wrapping its head around, that the vice presidential candidate of the Republican Party would say such a thing. Donald Trump himself tweeted out that his next administration will be fantastic for women's reproductive rights, using the language of the pro-abortion movement, calling abortion, you know, framing it as a part of a reproductive rights. So, you know, if you follow what they're saying and you take them seriously, you have to just say, wow, they're totally waving the white flag on this. And that has many people in the pro-life community, many pro-life voters, a bit confused as to what to do. Though obviously the Democratic ticket is, you know, they had an abortion van at their convention last week and pledged to go as far as possible. It has the pro-life movement thrown off guard. I'll say this about predicting, though, what's going to happen in terms of how the Democrats might be able to, what the outcome of this may be. We're in an election cycle where there are so many firsts, there are so many new things, that this really is a difficult race to predict. And all these ballot measures are, you know, in a sense, difficult to predict, too, particularly how they'll affect the state election outcomes. This is the first time in history we've ever had sort of a truncated campaign like this.
Right.
We don't really know what effect the Kamala Harris is going to have on the abortion vote, on the overall vote. And this is also the first national election where there's a presidential race going on in the post-Roe versus Wade world. And so this is all kind of an experiment. It's not necessarily obvious how all of these ingredients stir together and what it is we're going to be looking at. Right now, you're seeing a lot of expectation setting on both sides. I saw Ron DeSantis in Florida, governor of Florida, last week, say that if trying to rally his voters, if the amendment passes in Florida, that is, quote, the end of the pro-life movement. You also have the New York Times ran a piece last week where they are saying, well, okay, let's temper ourselves because, you know, yes, we have won 7 out of 7 of these races for the abortion ballot amendments, but this one's going to be tougher because we're in red states, because we have to get the 60-plus threshold. So it's a lot like what you get before a political debate, a presidential debate, where everybody wants to set the expectations. But it seems pretty clear that Democrats in the pro-abortion movement feel that they have the wind at their back.
Absolutely, and for some good reason, in the sense that the 7 passed ballot initiatives on abortion went in the favor of the pro-abortion position, right? And in the last few years since Dobbs, that's what has happened, and you do see you do see this this rise in women voters, right? And certainly that is not all women who are favoring abortion here, but it certainly seems to have brought out or at least brought some registrations there. And Lila Rose came out in recent weeks tweeting about Trump and really pressuring him, saying, hey, you're no longer a pro-life candidate if you say these things. And so it's really an interesting position that the pro-life movement is in. Have you been following Lila Rose?
I have been, yes. And I think that she is giving voice to a lot of the frustration that's in the pro-life movement right now with the disconnect from the Trump Vance ticket from the Trump Republican Party. And this is something, if you go back to a couple of months ago at the rally in D.C., the pro-life rally in D.C., that tension was really beginning to simmer then. You could feel a disconnect between the major party and between the movement. But now it's really coming to a head. And what I think is going to be most telling about how this all shapes out is that the pro-abortion movement, they're shooting for a specific number. What I've read is they know if they can get 30% of Republican support for these, that they're all going to pass. Mm-hmm. And these comments coming out from Vance and Trump seem to be giving something like a green light to Republican voters who, okay, you know, they want to vote for Trump, but, you know, they're a little wary on the abortion question. So we're going to see a really interesting split in the ticket.
Yeah, I want to point our listeners, we're out of time, and I want to point our listeners to a ballot initiative map that we have at CatholicNewsAgency.com. It's an abortion on the ballot map. Scroll to the bottom of that page, and you'll see each of these states, and you'll be able to follow it. I'm so grateful for your coverage of this issue and your political coverage reporting. So thanks, Peter.
Thank you, Jeanette.
We're turning now to Solène Tadier, who is joining us to talk about the Paralympics. I didn't want to end this show on something negative. I think there's a great event happening in Paris right now following the Summer Olympics. So, Solène, thanks for being with us. I think the Paralympics really display some extraordinary determination from athletes who have overcome physical and mental challenges to compete at this level. So could you give us an overview of what are these games, what sports do they play, and are there some particular athletes you'd like to highlight?
These Paralympic Games run until September 8th, and this is the first time that Paris has organized them, because last time the Games were held in Paris in 1924, it didn't exist. So it's bringing together 169 delegations with over 4,000 athletes from around the world. The event, you know, always brings a lot of great activities. There are a total of 22 sports on the program, including some specialized sports like blind soccer, wheelchair, basketball, rugby, tennis, fencing, parathlon, sitting volleyball, and so on. And, you know, it always brings out a lot of wonderful human histories, human stories, sorry. There are definitely many believers. I don't know all of them, and we will discover many new stories, and many Christians. I would like to mention one American athlete. There are many Christians already competing, but there is this woman, paracyclist, Jamie Whitmore-Maines, who was awarded a gold medal at the 2016 Rio Games in the women's road race. She has won 12 world championships and also the 2014 FC Award for best female athletes with a disability. She said in an interview with Sports Spectrum in 2022 that she has just always grown up knowing that strengths come from God. And she says, I'm going to fail and screw up, but I trust God to pull me up.
Absolutely. You know, faith has actually been a big part of the Olympic Games, despite some of the deviant sexual identities that were on display at the opening. Faith is quite present, especially through the Holy Games Initiative. And that's got a Paralympic component, too. Can you talk about that?
Yes, absolutely, Jeanette. Faith was very much present already during the Olympic Games. I had an interview at the beginning of August with the Catholic Church delegate to the game, Bishop Emmanuel Gobillard. he told me that at the Olympic Village, a huge number of people, athletes and staff there, came up to him to ask for a blessing, a prayer. People from all walks of life, including non-believers, came to him. So he truly experienced that sports is a unique and privileged means of touching soul. The Catholic Church was present there, but through these Holy Games programs that we've already mentioned, but it is mobilizing even more for this session by offering what they call La Route Extraordinaire, the Extraordinary Route. It's a program that enables 630 people with disabilities to attend the Olympic events and learn about para sports themselves, to start these activities with the help of 500 Catholic volunteers.
Wonderful.
There will be also an opportunity for them to venerate the Christ's crown of thorns, which will be on display tomorrow, Friday, August 30, in the Church of Saint-Germain-l'Auxerrois in Paris. All athletes and faithful from around the world are invited by the church.
Of course, and at Notre Dame, they'll also be able to see the Olympic bell, which is now housed in Notre Dame Cathedral. So thanks, Solène, for joining us. And listeners, remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks for joining us on Register Radio here on EWTN. Together with Matthew Bunsen and my producer, Michael McCall, I'm Jeanette DeMello, and I pray that until next week, may God bless you.